How much of the Buddha? How much of the Dharma? How much of the Sangha? I will confess today, because I'm kind of pathologically honest, that I had a hard time coming up with a Dharma talk today that didn't have something to do with the climate crisis. It just seems I strongly believe that we are in an emergency situation, and that if things don't radically change in a way that most of us can't even get our minds around, that we are facing perhaps runaway climate change and devastation. So that's kind of like, well, I mean, what else do you talk about? And I also, I've been spending a lot of time on my chosen form of climate activism. So it was kind of difficult to get my mind out of that groove, because I do have an open letter to the Sangha that will be coming out soon to just kind of express my current thoughts on this whole situation and how to relate to it, how does the Sangha relate to it, and also to address some fears that people have that I think are completely, I mean, they're completely legitimate, and whether they're legitimate or not doesn't matter. People's fears that, like, if we're going to talk about this more, if we're going to address this, what does that mean to the Sangha? What does that mean in the Sangha? How's that going to change? Is the Sangha going to stop being a place that I enjoy coming? Is it going to stop being a place of refuge? Are you going to make us all go be activists? I mean, you know, like, so in a way, you know, I have that in the works. So I didn't want to just preemptively do that. And I also a recognition that, and I say this in that letter, one of the things that we're going to have to work on is a balance. I mean, we have to spend time doing things that renew us and restore us and, you know, and balance that with paying attention and, you know, responding appropriately. So basically, though, you know, we can't be in a constant state of emergency. We can't talk about this all the time. That there are going to be times, we have to have times for zazen, for ritual, for immersing ourselves in the teaching, about thinking about other stuff. So in a way, this was a good exercise for me as like, okay, you've been thinking about this stuff a lot. Like, let's shift and think about the Dharma through another lens. So it helped me to do that by going back to this book, The Zen Teachings in Challenging Times. And the next chapter that we hadn't covered yet is called Finding Peace by Diane Shoshin Fitzgerald. And it helped me to just kind of get inside another teacher's head for a while and just kind of, all right, you know, here's something that just completely unrelated, not completely unrelated, of course, to our crisis, but not explicitly related, and then just kind of riff off of that. So this is finding peace. So obviously it's very relevant as well. So I want to just kind of throw out for you to consider, which I know I ask you with some regularity, what is it you really want out of your practice? And if all that you really want out of your practice, out of your meditation, out of your study, out of your participation in Sangha, if that's all you really want is just a little less stress, that is fine. There's no, you know, if you were a really cool Buddhist, this is what you would want out of your practice. This is you know, the way that my teachers modeled sharing the Dharma was, you know, they named their Zen center Dharma Rain, and it's from an image in the Lotus Sutra where the rain of Dharma falls on all kinds of beings, trees and herbs and bushes and whatever, and they all just take up what they need. So it's always, Dharma is always offered in that sense. People can take up what they need. We have one long-term person, he's been coming for years, he just comes to meditation and then leaves. You know, and that's like, you know, that you're very welcome to do that. So this isn't saying that you should want some particular thing out of your practice. But I would imagine that for many of us, this resonates to some extent. Do you want peace? And the definition of peace, always got to explore words. Now, there's a state of tranquility or quiet. This is kind of externally focused, such as freedom from civil disturbance, a state of security or order within a community, freedom from dispute or dissension. So that's kind of external peace. And then the second definition, it's really more about internal peace, freedom from disquieting or oppressive thoughts or emotions. So naturally, we want our lives to be fortunate and comfortable, externally peaceful. That's just completely natural that we would want that external peace. But we know that even sometimes when our lives are fairly free from that external conflict, we don't necessarily have the inner peace. The freedom from disquieting or oppressive thoughts or emotions. And but we also know, and on the other hand, that it is possible to have that kind of inner peace no matter what is going on. So sometimes there can even be external lack of peace, but internal peace. So what I want, one way to put it, would be unconditional internal peace. And peace isn't necessarily the first word that I would choose. Calm, definitely the freedom from disquieting or oppressive thoughts or emotions resonates. Freedom from agitation, worry, anger, doubt. And I kind of feel more of a resonance toward the positive, toward the result of being peaceful. Kind of think about, you know, if a nation or a state is in a state of peace, what then it is able to do, because it is not in a state of agitation and conflict and whatever, then it's all these things it is able to do or be. So I'm kind of, for me, it's the resulting confidence or collectedness or focus, undefendedness, that when I feel some degree of inner peace, this is how I'm more able to be. So, throat open a little bit. Do you want peace? Is that part of your deeper longing in any of the ways that I have defined it? What does that really mean to you? Can you think of moments where you felt that kind of peace, and what did it feel like? Just open it up for anyone who wants to say something. Do you want peace? Is that part of your deeper longing? What does it really mean? What does it feel like?
I feel like when I'm doing the right thing, especially for another human being,
there's a sense of rightness, like things are okay. for me when I associate with this idea of peace.
Tricky for me because sometimes I associate peace with apathy or being lethargic. You know, I sort of had this experience working from home the last few years. I feel like I've gotten a lot lazier. And you know, so when I think of peace, sometimes it's like, you know, too much peace or tranquility could be a bad thing, I guess. If that's a cynical way of looking at it, it just kind of came to my mind.
That's a good point. I mean, I think that's, for me, that's probably why peace isn't the first thing. We're like, what do you really want out of your practice? You know?
I also feel exactly what you mean about how too much stillness can start to feel itchy. I think one of the more, I reflected, what's one of the more peaceful moments I've experienced? And a thought came to mind of when I was having breakfast with a friend of mine in Brooklyn many years ago. It was summer. And in that moment, peace was really multifaceted. Like, there was the element of connection with my friend, and the walls of where we were having brunch was open, like it was one of those little open bistro windows, so there was fresh air, and like there was this sense of being with nature, so that was an element. And it was warm, so there was like physical comfort. And I had plans to go to the beach later, so it was a sense of communing with friends, but also having things to look forward to. Like, there were all these little small things that clicked together to create a moment of peace. Without one of them, I don't think it would have been the same.
I like that.
I'd say peace isn't the first word that comes to mind for me either, but when I think about time to touch that quality, I think of alignment. There's no other place that I'm needing to be, no other thing I need to be doing. Like, I really touched that on retreat when I like carved out the time. Like, I've taken care of everything, and this is where I'm wholeheartedly going to be. And actually, holding vigil for my dad as he passed was one of those moments just suspended in time. Like, this is completely where I want to be, need to be. There's kind of nothing else other than this, what's going on right now. So those are moments of, even in moments of like strong emotion, moments of peace and tranquility and alignment. So that's all
I think contentment is another good word to use for that. I feel content here in the Sangha. And when I'm doing things with other Sangha members outside this building of the poetry group and the Burke group and the Sesshin. So I don't have quite the peace in my head yet that I'd like, but I am a lot more content than I used to be.
I think that
it's a whole body experience. There's a settling into gravity, if you will, where there's this sense of really being supported by the earth, and at the same time, in that letting go, resting, settling, sinking, whatever it is, there's a sense of openness. And so the peace is whatever it is in that moment. I might be by myself, I might be with someone else, but there's this sense of allowing to come through. I think it's, for me, it really comes from that place of really surrendering into the support that's already there. So I can open up.
So many different aspects to it. I mean, it's obviously a very multifaceted experience. Now, what about when we find our peace, assuming we at least have it sometimes, more or less. What about when it's challenged? You know, things result in us losing our freedom from disquieting or oppressive thoughts or emotions. I guess what kind of things challenge your inner peace? For me, it's definitely trying to get too many things done.
I have this metaphor, and somewhere back in here, I'm the older version, that I most of the time rely on having a purpose. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times, my purpose is similar to getting the bedspread smooth so there are no wrinkles. And but sometimes I must have a problem space, and so then I'm in pursuit of this problem space. And I'm looking, so I have a system for looking for the wrinkles or where they are to smooth them out. And I think, yes, I like the first is contentment, because I think when I have some sense of purpose, but I'm not driven, somewhere in there is this contentment. At least that's the way it looks to me this morning.
Does reading the news challenge your inner peace? I mean, and I guess I shouldn't say reading the news, but just what's happening in the world. And so kind of the next step of the inquiry then is, you know, what do we do? What do we do to try to regain or strengthen our inner peace? And I think I'm not going to open it up because I think you're all going to have really good suggestions. So I'm going to talk first of all about kind of the less successful ways. I mean, the kind of the typical ways, which is kind of isolating ourselves in some way from what's disturbing. Taking a break is worth it at times, but sometimes we just kind of want to keep things at arm's length. Kind of talking ourselves out of things, you know, like you shouldn't be upset about that, you know, like find, you know, mental gymnastics to try to find our way back to not being disturbed. I guess I could throw this out to like not so successful ways. Adopting philosophies. I guess what I find myself doing sometimes is, you know, I'm confronted with something really disturbing, like the pictures of koalas, and then my mind like looks away from the pictures of the burned koalas and toward like, well, we should, you know, change our economies and you know, stop fossil fuel use. Like I have an answer or a philosophy or a worldview or something that would, you know, that wouldn't happen. If kind of I just got my way, if only we did this, then that wouldn't happen. And it's a way of, I mean, I don't know necessarily that that's inner peace, but it can help me be less upset because I have an answer. It's a kind of a way of distancing myself from the reality because that wouldn't happen if only I could get my way and fix things. So I don't know. That's just one kind of gyration that I go through. So I don't know if anybody has any other.
You made it
I think I would, yeah.
Find if I jump to fix-it mode, I actually generate more disquiet in myself. Mm. Because when I do that, I've lost my genuineness, my integrity, and my compassion, because I'm not allowing myself to really have empathy for what the experience is. So I do just the opposite and stay with, even if it's painful, because that to me is just more authentic for me, and so more peaceful. And then I can go to problem solving.
Shoshin Fitzgerald talks about kind of a dualistic approach to trying to achieve inner peace, even through our zazen. So she says, when zazen is undertaken to achieve inner peace and reduce outer conflict, no matter how laudable these goals, the activity is inherently dualistic, because it relies on the notion of a self that needs improvement to become more peaceful, being judged by another self that knows what that improvement looks like. This dualism creates the conditions for an internal war between the self that needs to be more peaceful and the imagined, perfectly peaceful self. There might even be a third self engaged in this battle, the trainer self that imposes the regimen for attaining inner peace, like a marathon training coach. The hapless self, the perfect self, and the trainer self are all engaged in a struggle. A strategy such as this, born in conflict and separation, cannot possibly liberate us from our inner turmoil or guide us through an outer world of strife. So sometimes, despite our best efforts to meditate or let go of attachment or consider the Buddhist teachings or whatever it is that we do, you know, that is some fairly successful, healthy way of regaining our inner peace. You know, sometimes there's still just a fair amount of disquieting or oppressive thoughts or emotions. Or maybe we're fairly at peace, but then someone in a Dharma talk starts talking about, like, really profound peace, and then we realize our ordinary peace is pretty inadequate. Isn't quite match our aspirations. And we might feel we're missing out to some extent on those positive aspects I mentioned earlier, kind of confidence, collectedness, focus, because we're kind of, I don't know, when like Chintai was talking also, I was thinking about the sense of being kind of undivided and wholehearted in things. And that's kind of, I feel like, kind of goes hand in hand with this sense of peace. And when we're not like that, then we're kind of all over, got kind of just a sense of agitation. Things aren't quite right. We got to take care of this. I don't know. And then we can't be as present or appreciative or wholehearted in things. So, she says, what then does Zen offer as an alternative? A couple people have touched on this already. Zen practice invites us to entertain the possibility that peace may not look the way we imagine it. Instead of trying to create a self that feels and acts more peaceful, Zen asks us to abandon our conception of a self at peace and consider the much more radical possibility that there may be no self that needs to find peace. Anything we imagine as inner peace may be nothing more than what the Diamond Sutra calls a star in space, an illusion, a dewdrop, a bubble, a dream, a cloud, a flash of lightning. If we unhook ourselves from our idea of inner peace, we may find ourselves abandoning our strategies for achieving this constructed idea of peace. When we desist from conceptualizing what inner peace might look like, we can find ourselves in a place of profound not knowing. This state of not knowing can be very generative. Shinryu Suzuki Roshi famously called this state of profound not knowing beginner's mind. In the beginner's mind, there are endless possibilities, he said, but in the expert's mind, there are few. So, this is just a radically different way of achieving peace. I mean, there's still things that we do in practice that are kind of the dualistic way. You know, fine, you set things aside and you meditate and kind of clear your mind. But kind of more, at a deeper level, we have this opportunity to just drop all of our ideas. So we say this is about dropping all views, not creating Buddhist ones so that we make sense of the world and feel better. It's dropping all views, our ideas of self, our ideas of peace, and kind of what's left is this not knowing, but it's a very open, sufficient, strangely peaceful place. I did that today during Zazen. Just thought, I don't know how to do Zazen. I don't know who I am. I don't know what's going on in the world. I don't know what should happen. There's just this, I don't know, kind of like a waking up and coming home, because that's really what's true. That's really the truth of the matter. I don't know what comes next. The whole Buddhist teaching is that there's no inherently existing, enduring self nature in here that is at peace or is not at peace. Or so, I mean, does this resonate at all with people's experience, this sense of kind of letting go into not knowing, and ironically there being some peace there?
My experience, when the Buddhist teachings say there is no self, I think it takes, I guess it's up to your karmic conditionings, but I think it takes many years of trying to fix that self before you realize it's a futile. And I think, at least for me, to even experience for a bit that there's another way of being, can be very liberating, but it's a very slow process. And just this is simple, but takes a lot of letting go. That's my experience. Because I've heard no self since I started. But it didn't make any sense to actually play all the games with self and then say this.
It takes courage. I like the image of Chosen Bays talked about it as like you're gonna go into the ocean and just learn how to just kind of float and swim in the ocean, but it's scary. Go up and you put your toe in, you know. And that kind of like approach to letting go is not something we just most of us, and actually it's good that we can't just let go all at once. I mean, we have healthy parts of our being are like, whoa, 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 you know. But we let go and we find out it's okay, and we let go more and we find out it's okay. Build up that habit over time.
There's curiosity to it too. You used the word undefended earlier, which is a favorite for me too. And there's this sense of, you know, I want to meet the person who emerges from a life that's beyond strategies.
Isn't that why we practice?
Yeah.
Because it's endless. Mm. It is endless. And it's beyond this lifetime.
But isn't it kind of counterintuitive that you could achieve peace by not trying to achieve peace? By letting go of that idea. And ironically, achieve peace. I mean, we talk about like the goal of goallessness. This kind of goal. It's dropping goals, but ironically, there is a reward in it. I mean, we can just be in the midst of, she talks about, everything is included, including our desire for peace and our disquieting thoughts and emotions, etc. It's all part of it. Let me read a little more. She says it very nicely. Having abandoned our idea of peace and our strategies for achieving it, we may find ourselves present to the ever-changing, groundless nature of being alive. What could this be like? We don't have a frame of reference for it. It's not about achieving some transcendent experience. Rather, it is about being alive to our life exactly as it is. Experiencing our life not as an observer, but as part of it, as the whole of it. Is this no self, or is it everything is self? It can't be pinned down by words. Even our human frailty is part of it. Master Dogen wrote, "Therefore flowers fall even though we love them. Weeds grow even though we dislike them." Our regret, yearning, and wanting things to be otherwise are poignantly included, just like the flowers and weeds that cover the earth. If we try to exclude violence and tragedy, we find ourselves back in the mode of trying to construct a reality from the safe distance of the observer, even when we know it is the distance that brings us so much pain. When we risk vulnerability to life just as it is, truth can be realized in a moment of life springing forth unbidden. Then there's only the continuous dynamic functioning of life in which self and other are not two. The surprising thing is that this real, powerful, and connected life is not different from the life we already have. This is the meaning of Zen's invitation to wake up to our lives right here and now. So in that sense, that's where this can be an unconditional peace. Because it's not dependent on anything. And not only is it not dependent on like external circumstances being peaceful, we actually even have to just open ourselves up to the non-peacefulness. Otherwise, we're not really at peace. Unless there is this undefendedness and this openness and this inclusion. So ironically, I mean, we have to be gentle with ourselves and patient with ourselves and work on our practice, you know, seek support. But, you know, I'm not really at peace until I can look fully at those awful things. Until I can look fully at the pictures of the burnt koalas and not try to make sense of it, not try to push it away, not try to make it okay, but to just and there's an ironic way in which that's peace. We come home to ourselves and we're just fully present, and we realize, like, we don't have to have the answers in order to be fully authentic, to be doing our best to appreciate our lives. And this is why people like, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh and the Dalai Lama are just radiantly joyful. Even though it's not because they've been insulated from tragedy. They've witnessed it and been part of it and are fully aware of it. Ongoing injustices and awful things. And yet, they have this ground of appreciation and joy. So hopefully in my climate activism, I can offer some of that to my fellow activists. Hopefully we Buddhists can share some of this with the friends and family and the people that we interact with. It's a certain kind of peace and confidence that isn't about, well, it'll be okay, we'll get reborn in heaven and everything will be fixed there. It's not based in any kind of concrete belief. Any last thoughts or comments? Yeah.
No, not knowing, except we don't know anything. We don't know how we exist to start with. So not knowing is completely to be okay because we don't know. I don't know how we came or how we started. So when we don't know that basic thing, not knowing is okay.
It's not about not taking responsibility. It's not saying, "Oh, who cares?" But this not knowing, this true not knowing, is a great burden off our shoulders. You know, our sense of knowing is really about trying to control the future. I know how you're going to act, and I know what I believe, and I know what the layout of this room is, and so, you know, I mean, it's a useful evolved aspect of our being, but it's just, I like to call it, it's like a mental map of the world, and that's not really the world. It's useful in our daily lives, but that's not really the world. So we can just let it go. For moments, you have to pick it back up in order to, like, go to work and pay your bills and stuff, but we can, in moments, just let it go, and then...
That's why that Zen master said, not knowing is most intimate. Mm. When you don't know, you will be in contact with life. It's when you know that gets in the way of good thinking about it.
And I think... Wouldn't it be awesome to be able to go into not knowing, you know, go into a conversation, a difficult conversation with somebody you really, really disagree with, and to, my knowing is going to come right up. My knowing is going to just be like, well, But, you know, if we could be in that space of not knowing, we would just be paying attention to what's going on. We'd just be paying attention to that person. Not trying to win an argument. And chances are we'd probably have more of an effect, more of a positive effect than with all of our knowing.
I'm just looking today at the cries of the world comes in and thinking we should have some koalas.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Some of the Australian animals.
Yeah, I inspire, invite anybody. That's what that's there for just any of those things, that some kind of image of beings, natural systems, whatever, that are suffering, that we want to, that cause that arising of compassion, that just feels appropriate to me to have them represented here in some way. Anything else? All right, thank you all for coming. Oh, formal end to the Dharma talk. Hold on. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. The mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita.